This is a Suno India production, and you're listening to the Suno India Show.
Nupur Sharma's comments about the Prophet Muhammad on Times Now have now led to a series of events. She was removed from her position as the BJP spokesperson after nations in the Middle East took offense with her comments. Even the US administration has condemned the incident. And at home in India, protests have erupted in several states against her statement. There are FIRs against Sharma in West Bengal and Maharashtra. In these chain of events, there was another interesting incident. Mohammed Zubair, the co-founder of Alt News, shared Nupur Sharma's Times Now clip on Twitter and said, I quote, "Why do we need hate mongers like Yati Narsingh Anand Saraswati or Mahant Bajrang Muni or Anand Swarup to arrange a Dharam Sansad to speak against a community and a religion when we already have anchors who can do much better job from news studios?" This is in reference to the Dharam Sansad in Haridwar in December 2021, organized by Yati Narsingh Anand, where Hindu ascetics call for violence against Muslims. Mahant Bajrang Muni threatened sexual violence against Muslim women in April this year. Now there is a case against Zubair in Uttar Pradesh under the same charge of insulting religious beliefs. So when we talk about freedom of speech and of course freedom of the press, where do we draw the line? Where does free speech end and hate speech begin? What do our laws and our constitution say? As we see a growth in hate speech around us, we also see a fall in press freedom in India. From a rank of 142 out of 180 countries in 2021 World Press Freedom Index, this year we have fallen to a rank of 150. Hi, this is Surya Tapa Mukherjee, your host for this episode of the Suno India Show. Today, I will be speaking to V. Krishna Anand, a former lawyer and a journalist. He now teaches history at the Sikkim University, Gangtok. Last year, he wrote a book called Between Freedom and Unfreedom, The Press in Independent India, which chronicles the history of the Indian press. We explore some of these burning questions about what free speech means in India and what are its limitations. To start with, we know that there are limits to our freedom of speech, which also covers freedom of press. And there are limits to these freedoms, be it defamation, sedition, laws against promoting communal enmity, obscenity law, etc. On one hand, those looking for an expanded law on press freedoms have fought against this. But on the other hand, we're now dealing with a political climate where hate speech is proliferant. So what is your understanding of these freedoms?
I mean, let me put it this way. I think, you know, the limits of this freedom or sort of, you know, I mean, where does the freedom end and where does the state come in? Where does the state come in? And the fundamental rights actually are very, very distinct in this for the simple reason that it places the onus of ensuring that one's fundamental rights are not infringed upon the state. And it also has a very, very important kind dimension to it, that the state shall not do anything to infringe the fundamental right. You know, my fundamental right to free speech is a right that shall not be infringed by any other person, any other citizen of this country, or anybody else in the world. That is number one. The police and the rest, the other arms of the state are meant to ensure that the fundamental rights of a particular citizen is not infringed upon by another citizen. This is at one level. The second part, when we are talking about the restrictions or the limitations, and that is where I would say that, like, you know, the free speech jurisprudence has pretty much advanced in our country, the constitutional sense of the term. The forum where actually whether a law as enacted by the state infringes upon free speech or not is the higher judiciary. What is sort of, you know, I mean, creating a problem today. In fact, you know, the problem that the challenges before the right to free speech today in the context in which that we are talking is a group of citizens. And I have marked the words a group of citizens. I mean, getting together to prevent the expression, the right to express of a certain opinion by another citizen or another group of citizens. And the means that they adopt here is not anything to do with the law and the law of the land. On the contrary, the means that are adopted is violence and lumpenism. And, you know, this is not something that, like, you know, we should be talking about as if it happened yesterday or day before. I think, you know, when Deepa Mehta's film, Fire, subsequently a whole lot of cinema, I think, you know, Padmavat, and, you know, I mean, we can keep listing, and, you know, I don't think our audience need to be told as to which were all those films that were actually prevented from being screened. The means that, you know, were used to curtail the right to free expression of the director were not anything constitutional. If a certain set of people would actually approach the police station, go to the court and say, like, you know, look, I mean, this should not be done, then, you know, the onus is upon the state to decide as to whether it should be done or not. And, you know, the state has no other choice but to go by whether a certain cinema was cleared by the censor board and, you know, allow it. And in the sense, allow it in the sense in it, to ensure, to protect. And that is what Article 19.1a envisages. That is what the constitutional scheme envisages, that the state has to protect against infringement of the fundamental right to free expression, as long as that freedom is not really in excess of the reasonable limitations that are imposed. And this is where I think, you know, the challenge comes today. So instead of actually sort of, you know, looking at it as some kind of, you know, the rise of a certain political idea, I would actually want to get, sort of, you know, describe the situation as the state consciously failing or reneging in its constitutional mandate. The state reneging upon the constitutional mandate upon it to ensure the freedom of expression of every citizen of this country.
So how has our understanding of hate speech and free speech changed over time? Has social media changed the way we look at these categories?
Well, I mean, I would say yes and no. But, you know, let me sort of, you know, I mean, come around this this point, you know, once again, like, put it like this. I mean, there wasn't so much of an amplification of whatever was spoken in times when, you know, social media had not arrived. I would actually blame not just the social media. In fact, you know, I would blame the television media for the rise of this kind of a tendency, which Marshall McLuhan, I think, would call the society of the spectacle. And this particular tendency has actually sort of, you know, given rise to amplification of, such lunatics, such raves and rants in society. And the social media then sort of, you know, reacts to it, responds to it, and, you know, even a statement that should have, I mean, I'll tell you an example. I think this is an example that, you know, I always remember working as a journalist at a point of time and reporting from the Rajya Sabha. There was a particular moment on a Friday when a certain member of parliament, and incidentally, you know, this particular member of parliament belonged to a party which professes atheism. He is today a very important leader of the Communist Party of India, Marxist, in West Bengal. I think, you know, he's the secretary of the state committee. At about sometime past 1 o'clock, he raised the issue that it's time to adjourn the house. Now, it was some kind of a, what do you call, like, you know, everything was out of place. Here was a Communist Party of India member of parliament who wanted to the house to be adjourned, on account that, like, you know, it was time for the namaz. And there was the chairperson, and sometimes, like, you know, I mean, roles change and all those things. Najma Hepatullah, she was a Congress leader at that point of time before she joined the BJP. And Najma actually sort of, you know, very, very spontaneously came up with this reactions, this response that, agar, I mean, if you want to go, you're free to leave the house. I mean, nobody is held in bondage to sit here and sort of, you know, participate. But, you know, you can't expect the house to be adjourned. This was something that, like, you know, all of us sitting there in the reporter's gallery thought that, like, you know, we need to report this from several angles. And, I mean, when we were coming out, you know, there was an elderly reporter who was also, incidentally happened to be from the Statesman, Keith Flory. When we were actually picking up our bags from the counter coming out of the gallery, Keith said that, like, you know, my own suggestion would be that we should not report this. In the event we report it, all our papers will carry it on page one. And, it'll become a big news. You know, everybody is going to, some of the Maulanas are going to attack Najma, and, you know, everybody is going to muse over it for the next 2 or 3 days. So as journalists, we have a responsibility that we are not going to amplify this. Let it sleep. And we decided to sleep. I mean, that this whole thing should sleep. And probably, like, you know, if any one of us had actually decided not to do it, we'd have got a byline, we'd have got a few minutes of glory the next morning that, like, you know, I mean, my story is on page one. But the consequence of it would have been that a position that Najma had taken at that point of time, she would probably have been forced to sort of, you know, I mean, backtrack on it or something of the kind, you know, there could have been a fatwa and so on and so forth. So this is where I think, you know, a sense of responsibility towards the society, and what is not really listed out among the reasonable restrictions. That is, like, you know, I mean, you need to decide what are the consequences of what you do. And as a journalist, I think, you know, it's important that, you know, the consequence of what you write and what you speak is very, very important. So in that sense, I think, you know, a television turning into some kind of, you know, I mean, a place for raving and ranting. In fact, you know, I mean, Nupur Sharma should have been told very clearly by the anchor at that point of time that, no, this is not the place for any such remarks. And she must have been asked to get out of the studio. She must have been asked to get out of the studio. And, you know, it ends there. Now, what happens for a week or so, like, you know, I mean, her own sort of, you know, political masters defend her. You know, it's made into a big issue. And it now has turned out to one of these mobilizations. And, you know, I'm really sort of, you know, at a loss to understand. I mean, why was such a mobilization not taking place? Let us say on the question of the rise in prices. Cooking oil prices have gone up, I mean, twice as much. There is a huge, I mean, day an increase in prices of petrol and petroleum products day by day. The cost of living has really gone up. Employment has really fallen. Now, I mean, I am at a loss as to whether these things, which should have, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, let's go back to another era in the 70s when there was a price rise accounting for about 27% in 3 years. I'm talking about the years between 1971, 72 and 73, 74, 75. In the 3 years, prices of essentials and commodities rose by 27%. And it led to student unrest in Gujarat, what is called the Navnirman Andolan. It led to sort of, you know, similar kind of, and it led to one of the greatest industrial, the single largest industrial working class action, that is the railway strike in 1974. The price rise and the demand for compensation on that was, I mean, these are the forces behind it. Students in university hostels rose in revolt. They rose against the state. They got beaten up. They got into jails. Now, what has happened in, let's say, the 40 years and, you know, close to 50 years, that, like, you know, price rise, which is several fold larger than what it was in the 70s, a certain kind of a crisis where, you know, informal sector employment has fallen. None of this have actually sort of, you know, risen to at the same time. So in some sense, like, you know, there is, in my view, a larger distortion that has taken place in society. A larger distortion. And that is probably where I think, you know, the media comes in. The media at one level amplified a certain remark. And what does it add up in the end? It has added up to a situation where a certain kind of a fundamentalism, or whether it is minority or, you know, majority communalism, has taken center stage in the democratic discourse. And this is the context, unfortunately, where we end up discussing, let's say, freedom of expression. I mean, one doesn't talk about the freedom of expression about sort of, you know, I mean, nobody's talking about the Pegasus. The media is not talking about the Pegasus, which was a bigger scandal involving the state, where Article 19.1A was infringed upon. If the stories are right. Now, we are not talking about it. The media is a goal. I mean, I think day in and day after, we are concerned about whether Nupur Sharma had the right to free speech or not. Now, there is a provision in the Indian Penal Code. Section 153B is what should have been used. And where has this come? I mean, at one level, like, you know, somebody is talking as to whether Nupur Sharma has the freedom to speak or not, which in the normal course of things should have been dealt with under 153B of the Indian Penal Code.
There are several cases against Nupur Sharma right now, but at the same time, there's also a case against Alt-News' Mohammed Zubair for calling Hindu fears hate mongers on Twitter. Both have been accused of insulting religious beliefs. So what for you are the similarities and the differences between these two?
Something that happened when the Supreme Court quite recently, finally, at long last, took up Section 124A. And, you know, the petitions against 124A bundled together and it took them. And, you know, gave some kind of what we can call an interim kind of a judgment, saying that, like, you know, 124A must be put on hold. Likewise, I think, you know, I mean, there were several, and this came after many, many instances of high courts, particularly the Madras High Court, Madurai bench, uniformly striking down the FIRs based on 124A complaints. This is something that, like, you know, I was talking about, like, this is not using the law. In fact, you know, this is a very, very clear case of the law being abused, an abuse of the legal provision. Zubair's case is very illustrative. Whereas by 1969-70, the Supreme Court had actually transcended into what is called the due process of law, the fundamental difference being what is the consequence of a certain legal judicial action. I mean, the law might actually proclaim to say something, and, you know, it might actually have another effect. In terms of, you know, let's say political rights or human rights, the Maneka Gandhi case and a whole lot of such cases were instances where the Supreme Court very clearly said that, you know, even if you follow the procedure, the consequence was very important. And if only this is taken into account. And if only, like, you know, I mean, the judiciary, the higher judiciary also goes another step forward, apart from being proactive and taking up all these cases or more too, also goes a step forward that, like, you know, if some action by a police is considered, is perceived, is actually established as an abuse of the law, then the concerned police official from bottom to top, the concerned secretary, the home secretary, if those people are also sort of, you know, warned, if they're punished for contempt of the law, in terms of, you know, imposing big fines or, you know, stripping them down. So if some such sort of, you know, I mean, things are done, then, like, you know, I mean, I don't think an FIR will ever be registered against, let's say, Mohammed Zubair. What did Zubair do. I mean, well, he amplified what Nupur Sharma said on the media at a point of time when Nupur Sharma herself and, you know, people around her were telling that she didn't say anything. I would argue that Zubair's statement should be, as a matter of fact, taken as a complaint. That Zubair was doing his constitutional duty. Somebody's fundamental right was infringed upon, and that is the freedom of conscience to profess any religion was infringed upon, and that the state has to step in to ensure that the violator is taken care by law, which is what a policeman should have done, So let's not be innocent that, like, you know, I mean, the kind of infringement that takes place is a fault of the law. On the contrary, I think, you know, it's a kind of political culture, and which is again where I think, you know, the media has played a role in propping up this culture. I think, you know, the television channels, and if my understanding of the law is correct, the platform from where Nupur Sharma expressed such, gave such statements, is equally responsible in the eyes of law to have sort of, you know, committed a breach of the law. I think, you know, I mean, one of the challenges to freedom, and this is something that, you know, was expressed in the Constituent Assembly. In fact, you know, when the First Amendment, particularly the aspect of the amendment to Article 19(2) was discussed in the Constituent Assembly between 16th of May and the 2nd of June 1951. Towards the end of the debate, the then Prime Minister Nehru talks about the challenges to freedom. And he very specifically makes this point. When we talk about freedom, we always talk about freedom from the state, the laws, whether the laws should actually allow more freedom and less freedom, and the state is placed on the other. But then what about that lack of freedom, or sort of, you know, the attack on freedom, or the challenges to such freedom of expression in the press, that comes from, let's say, the owners, those who own the press. And he said even that has to be dealt with. In fact, that is a very, very significant kind of an intervention. Soon after the first general elections, and, you know, the cabinet comes in, there is what is called the First Press Commission under a retired judge called Justice Rajat Daksha, which is appointed. And the First Press Commission actually came out with this very, it actually analyzed all the laws. Its brief was very clear as to identify all the challenges present and the potential challenges to, let's say, free press. And the commission actually comes out, it analyzed all the laws that existed. And it said, like, you know, I mean, challenges from the state are more or less been taken care of. The Constitution, as in Article 19(1A), and the reasonable restrictions that are in sort of, you know, very clearly enlisted, not just illustrated, but enlisted in Article 19(2), are sufficient guarantees that, you know, the state is not going to infringe upon the freedom. And I would say that except for the dark phase of 19 months of the emergency, whose anniversary we will be celebrating in another 10 days, the 25th of June, except during the emergency, I would say that, you know, India's press India's press has been free. The challenges, let us say, from what is called the business interest, the business model. In fact, you know, that was the biggest challenge to even such newspapers like the Indian Express and the Statesman during the emergency. In fact, you know, during the emergency, what the government did, and, you know, they did it, you know, 3 days after, 4 days after the emergency was proclaimed, on 29th of June 1975, the Press Information Bureau was asked to formulate a list of newspapers under three categories: hostile, neutral, friendly. And the PIB actually did the categorization, and this categorization was based on the editorials written by these newspapers between the 12th of June, that is the day after the Lavada High Court judgment, and the proclamation of emergency. I mean, just 13 days, and the editorial position that these papers had taken was to be the basis on which somebody was called hostile and somebody was called, I think, yeah, the Statesman came with the hostile category, the Indian Express came with the hostile category. And this was used in contravention of a solemn declaration by the government in 1955 when the DAVP, the Advertisement and Visual Publicity Department, was created to ration and reduce the advertisement revenue of such papers, newspapers that were considered hostile. And at a time when, you know, the circulation of these newspapers were increasing because they were hostile. Nobody wants adversarial press, like Robin Jeffrey talks about, like it is, it's a very important factor in democracy. And such papers with curtailed advertisement revenue, when their circulation was increasing, they suffered endlessly because they broke the business model. The cover price was not sufficient for them to recover the production cost. So in a sense, like, you know, I mean, the government actually did what Chomsky would otherwise talk about, sort of not just flak, but also sort of inducements to sort of, you know, contain the press in India. Now, having learned that lesson, the press actually came out of this kind of an illusion. But all the while, a business model was something that actually, so, I mean, what the first press commission talked about, it said, like, you know, I mean, close to 50% of the newspaper readership was catered to by newspapers that were controlled by five families. Just five families controlled the readership of 50% of the newspaper reading population in 1953. And it talked about another 25 families that controlled another 35%, which means 85% was controlled by 30 families. And this is where they actually said, like, you know, this is where the challenge to freedom of expression and a free press is likely to arise. And they talked about, you know, the pages and the prices order and so on. But somewhere, like, you know, I mean, all these things were coming into place. Every newspaper was sort of, you know, I mean, settling down with it. But the 1991, what is called the unlimited opening up of India, what is otherwise called liberalization, I mean, I'm very uncomfortable with the term liberalization. I would say, like, you know, just opening the economy and throwing it to the wolves. The untrammeled kind of an opening up and all, which Vanita Kohli Khandekar actually treats as, you know, the period of boom. And it was a boom period for all the newspapers, somewhere about until about 2006. And post 2006, when the economy began to shrink, particularly with the slowdown in the real estate, in the automobile sector, and so on and so forth. And by about 2015, that shrinking was definitely sort of, you know, a lot more pronounced. The newspapers or the television, and the televisions were anyway not making too much money. They were only sort of, you know, positioning the owners into influential players and things like that. So in some sense, I think, you know, this period was where, you know, the kind of unfreedom that the first press commission talked about was unfurling. The newspapers, economy, their finances were doing bad, and COVID came as a situation where, you know, journalists could be just thrown out. I mean, I think, you know, a few hundred journalists lost their jobs during those bad times. And which is also where I think some of the regulations that the government brought in on recommendations from the first press commission were significant. The first press commission actually said that, like, you know, journalists have to be, their working conditions and their salaries have to be regulated. There was something called the wage boards and so on and so forth. And from there, today we have actually come to a stage where our reporters do not understand what is dearness allowance. Dearness allowance is a kind of a compensation for price rise. But, you know, every 6 months you'll find newspapers, I mean, basically, like, a newspaper. This is an era of the package where the journalists actually surrendered their freedom themselves by entering into contracts and all. A hard-won freedom which actually regulated. In fact, there was this case of B.G. Verghese, who was editor of the Hindustan Times on the day the emergency was declared. He had already had his own problems with his proprietor, K.K. Birla. Verghese actually brought out about 1,500 copies of the Hindustan Times, splashing the news of arrest and the declaration of emergency, before which the shutters were brought down. And Birla wanted to get rid of him. But Verghese fought a case in the labor court. I mean, an editor of a newspaper in 1975 treated himself as a worker, went to the labor court to fight a case against his management, that the management could not have thrown him out summarily kind of a thing. He won the case. The Delhi High Court upheld the order. So in some sense, when actually sort of, you know, journalists, the middle collar, stopped calling them workers, stopped considering them as workers, there were two things that happened. Any kind of a struggle that happens outside on the streets becomes a law and order problem, is perceived as a law and order problem. And that combined with what I sort of, you know, earlier referred to as, you know, the society of the spectacle, and, you know, this kind of raising a dust and storm, the breathless quest for sort of, you know, I mean, my story grabbing a lot more time, including by the reporters. So in some sense, like, you know, while at one level there is a systemic problem, there is also a loss of character, particularly among a generation of the journalists that has created the situation that, you know, where freedom has been surrendered.
So where does freedom of speech end and hate speech begin? How does the law look at this? And, like, ideally, you know, if we have to think about, like, an ideal free press, if that is possible, what does that look like?
Let me actually start from, you know, the basic. There's been a challenge to freedom. And, you know, the challenges are as old as, you know, the quest for freedom. And every challenge has come about alongside the quest for more freedom. So it's been some kind of a dialectical process. So I think, you know, the fundamental requirement in terms of defending the freedom of expression, particularly by, let's say, the media, the press, the media, is to sort of, you know, have the priorities very clear. What are we going to talk about? And this is something that, like, you know, we get to learn from the experience of the press in the 1980s, the period when, you know, the press as a mighty institution could prevent the then government with 415 members in parliament in the Lok Sabha enacting a law curtailing their freedom, the defamation law. The 1980s had a background. You know, when the press talked about the slum dwellers. I mean, Olga Tellis was a journalist. Praful Bidwai was a journalist. I mean, both of them were sort of, you know, I mean, not sort of, you know, working with any kind of a small-time newspaper, both of them in the Times of India. They talked about the slum dwellers in Bombay and took up their case and all those things, leading to a Supreme Court judgment that said that you may evict them if they are encroachers, but not before you give them another space to dwell, which is called the payment dweller space. Or Nirja Chaudhary writing for the Statesman about the state of bonded laborers who were released in Madhya Pradesh with a lot of fanfare. And that leading to a constitutionally significant judgment that the state has to not only release the bonded laborers, but rehabilitating them because it is the right to livelihood. I mean, so the whole right to life gets expanded in the process thanks to a very, very vibrant media, the press. I mean, this goes about, you know, the Bandhua Mukti Morcha, the condition of prisoners. The 1980s was a period when there was a jugalbandi outcall between, let's say, the media and the judiciary, which expanded the constitution and its humaneness, the constitution into a humane document, the provision. And all these based on, you know, what we call the fundamental rights. So what we need is, at the ground, you know, we need journalists who are very sensitive to the people to whom they are accountable. Because, I mean, there is something called freedom, not in abstraction, but freedom to advance, deepen democracy. And how does democracy get deepened? By empowering the people, not by empowering the state. empowering the state is antithetical to democracy. So, I mean, this is, I think, you know, the fundamental principle that should guide every journalist. How do I empower the people? When I think a journalist, when she wakes up in the morning, should ask the question, how am I going to empower the people today? Or sort of, you know, work in the whole process, aiding the empowerment of the people. And before going to sleep, interrogate oneself and say, like, you know, did I compromise? Did I empower the state in the process today? But what we actually see, I mean, this is the biggest challenge. The press is the biggest advocate, has been the biggest advocate for all kind of draconian laws, including the UAPA at various points of time. I mean, for instance, like, you know, describing a region as a Maoist infested region. Infested is maggot. Like the Maoists or like, you know, I mean, the kind of, you know, the kind of treatment that, like, you know, the resistance to land and disposition of the land in Nandigram and Shingur, the way it got described in the media. I mean, if it was a CPM friendly media, they called the protesters disruptors. Now, this is where I think, you know, there has to be what is called an introspection by the journalists. Having said that, I mean, it's easier said because, like, you know, I mean, the journalist has to, I mean, you are a journalist also because, you know, you need to earn money. Otherwise, like, you know, you could have as well become an activist. So that is where I think, you know, one needs to work a little hard. The third thing, of course, like, you know, there is need for huge reforms in the media ecology. I mean, what we encounter now is, lot more monopoly than what existed in 1954 when the First Press Commission looked at it as the danger. And I do see that, like, you know, I mean, I think social media has created that space. It's possible for small entrepreneurs to sort of, you know, get in there. But that alone is not the solution. I think, you know, what is necessary is, like, you know, we need to join hands with various other sections in society. There are still people who care for the idea of India and democracy. Not just among the journalists, but among the politicians, among the civil servants and so on and so forth. So such kind of networking becomes very important. And such kind of, you know, collect what I would call a community consciousness. A community consciousness shall also sort of, you know, I mean, ensure that some of the basic ethical standards are not violated. In other words, I mean, I can sort of, you know, without taking the name, I can say that, like, you know, I mean, at least I know of two very, very top-notch journalists who were caught on tape wheeling and dealing with politicians over ministerial appointments. I'm talking about, something that happened in 2004. Now, I would recall a similar kind of an instance in 1989 when the then External Affairs Minister Narasimha Rao, who became Prime Minister subsequently, played behind the scenes to get a journalist to put out a bogus story that V.P. Singh, who was a challenger to the Congress, V.P. Singh's son Ajay Singh had a shell account in one of those Singh Kids Islands. In one of those, scandalous kind of, you know, accounts. It turned out much later that, like, you know, the whole account opening form, everything was concocted by the Ministry of External Affairs. But then, the journalist who actually sort of, you know, put out the story, I had not entered journalism at that point of time, but, like, you know, I mean, he was already famous, so much so that, like, you know, I mean, nobody even cared to sit on the same table at the press club if he was there for a drink. Now, that is something that has changed. You have wheeler dealers operators today. All of us talk about them as wheeler dealer operator in private conversation. And nevertheless, like, you know, we don't want to sort of, you know, call them names or condemn them or distance ourselves from them in a public space. We socialize with them. Because there are people like us. So I think, you know, that is also where, you know, the community feeling should be filtered. I mean, there should be this very, very clear kind of an understanding that, you know, the black sheep among us are not to be defended. So I think, you know, some of these basic standards, what are very ethical, should be the starting point where we try to sort of, you know, I mean, get closer to freedom. I mean, I would say that, like, you know, the kind of freedom that India's press was sort of, you know, steeped in the glorious 1980s.
Please rate our podcast and leave a comment if you like it. Underreported and underrepresented stories can become mainstream only if it reaches more people. So please support us by visiting a contributing page on our website, sunoindia.in, or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.